adjourn the meeting. We have a quorum, and I'm sure that Representative Lean, I'm sure you read every bit of the minutes, haven't you?
I certainly have, Mr. Chair, and I will move them.
Okay, well, Representative Lean moves the minutes of what date was that? 10th, February 10th. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All against that motion say aye. Motion passes. And we have before us House File 211. Representative Keel, do you want to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to move House File 211.
And we're going to refer it to HHS Finance?
Yes, that's
very
correct.
Well. Mm-hmm. Representative Keel moves House File 211 and refers it to HHS Finance. Would you describe your bill for us, please?
I would. I actually, Mr. Chair, I would like to take a few minutes and let Mr. Gottwald explain a little presentation on rural health care.
I just can't wait.
And then we'll go from, or did we change? Okay, just make sure. And we'll do that real quickly, and then I'll introduce the bill. Thank you.
Welcome back, former Representative Steve Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Steve Gottwald. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Rural Health Association. We are a nonprofit membership organization with hundreds of members around the state, ranging from critical access hospitals, clinics, providers of all stripes, medical educators. It's an organization that really represents the interests of a whole lot of people who are very concerned about the state of rural health in Minnesota. We put together this report.
While we're at it, should we move A2 amendment?
Would you like to do that now?
Since he's going to testify on it, I believe. It's up to you. You're here, Bill.
Yeah, let's wait until we have this presented. Thank you.
All right.
So we put together this report, Mr. Chair and members, called the State of Minnesota Rural Health 2015. We expect it'll be an annual report. Rural communities in Minnesota, of course, are trying to address the triple goal of greater access to higher quality and more cost-effective health care. But they're doing it in many cases with challenges that are very different from what are faced in the metro area. We realize there are some similarities, but let's face it, rural Minnesota does have unique aspects to it that make health care, especially in this new environment, even more challenging. Some of the unique challenges: we have an older and lower income population by and large in rural communities, and they are more heavily dependent on public programs, which, as many of you know, pay below cost typically, which puts rural providers under even greater stress than usual. Hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, other providers increasingly under financial stress, many of them in danger of closing. We have limited access to dental, mental health, obstetrics, and other specialty care in rural communities. New health care requirements under the ACA and some of the things the state is doing on an ongoing basis. Because of these lesser resources, there is a greater challenge in trying to afford that. We also need access to skilled health care workforce and data analytics. And we'll get into some of the other things that are involved with these challenges on a more specific basis. The top issues we've identified as an organization are healthcare workforce shortage, which we'll talk about a little bit more in relationship to House File 211. Access challenges: as you might imagine, there are great distances between people, and we'll show you some statistics about that in a moment. Transportation is another major issue with those distances. Broadband shortage: we talk about mobile medicine and telemedicine being part of the solution for rural communities trying to bridge these distances with access to healthcare professionals through technology and telemedicine. That's hard to do when you don't have the broadband necessary to accomplish those things. There are many portions of rural Minnesota that simply don't have that. Reimbursement disparities: we talked about when you rely to a greater extent on public programs and those public programs don't pay enough, it puts you under unique financial stress. And then, as I mentioned, hospitals, clinics, nursing homes in crisis in rural communities pretty much across the board. The Minnesota Medical Association, the Hospital Association, and the Minnesota Department of Health have all predicted a physician shortage of between 800 to a few thousand in both primary and specialty care in rural Minnesota. There are fewer medical students who are choosing primary care, and fewer of those are choosing to serve in rural communities. That's a deep concern that goes directly to what Representative Keel is presenting in House File 211. Lack of funding, facilities, faculty, and the federal cap on residency slots also barriers to producing more rural health care providers. And then the recruiting challenges. The rural lifestyle is a unique one. Typically, if you're recruiting top shelf providers, you're going to need to also have jobs for their spouses, for example. So it is a unique challenge, particularly for rural Minnesota. Here's a pretty startling set of statistics about the healthcare workforce shortage across Minnesota. This is population per physician. So recognizing that in rural communities we have fewer people and they're more broadly dispersed, even given that, if you look at the Twin Cities metro area, you've got 297 people to every physician. Now, that's primary and specialty care, but you've got that ratio. As you move into small town, small rural Minnesota, that goes to 674 people per physician. If you go to what they call deep rural, the very small communities in rural Minnesota, 2,043 people, you know, more broadly dispersed, but that many people per physician, per MD. And I use that simply to illustrate the challenge that we have with rural healthcare workforce shortage. The access challenges, in addition to a growing shortage of the primary care, we lack access to certain specialty care, particularly obstetrics, mental health services and providers, dental care, language interpreters, and cultural navigators, because we do see increasing diversity in rural Minnesota. And pharmacy and medication therapy management services. Those are some of the top access challenges provider-wise. Transportation, as I mentioned, rural Minnesotans, they list, when they're surveyed, access to transportation as their top concern, particularly in the area of healthcare. And again, among seniors and aging population that often require door-to-door, the public services are not there to provide. In rural areas, in some cases, you simply don't have them. And so volunteers and community networks that are being cobbled together in many cases are doing a good job, a heroic job, but in some cases are simply not available. I mentioned broadband shortage. We know telemedicine is part of the solution in rural communities, but when you don't have the access, when you don't have the bandwidth, it's darn hard to do that. So we need to address broadband access across Minnesota. Reimbursement disparities. As I mentioned, rural communities rely heavily on public programs, which underpay and create financial stress for clinics, again, that are dealing with small numbers in the first place. This is making it a disproportionately difficult situation for rural providers. Despite a high percentage of Minnesotans with health insurance, many still face unaffordable deductibles and other barriers. And again, this is tougher when you have an older and poorer population in rural communities that are more widely dispersed. Hospitals, clinics, nursing homes in crisis. Because of this, let's give an illustration here. Hospitals in rural Minnesota are operating typically in the red or with margins of less than 5%. I mean, that's razor thin. So these are in jeopardy of closing, and they're really struggling. The healthcare infrastructure in much rural Minnesota.
Representative Mahoney has a question.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, and it's one of those rare occasions where a legislator asks a question that he or she really doesn't know the answer. But a razor-thin margin of 5% really doesn't have any meaning. What's the profit margin, or what's the margin in an urban, suburban, and rural? So if you could give us all three, that'd be helpful. I really don't know the answer to that.
We're waiting.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I don't have the exact comparison either. It'd be nice if I did. I've used this to illustrate the situation in rural communities right now, and I think most of us can appreciate that level, whether it's an urban hospital or a rural hospital, is darn thin. It's difficult. And there's numerous studies to support the fact that critical access hospitals in rural communities across this country are closing. And when one closes in a rural community, you don't have another one to go to.
Representative Mahoney.
In urban areas, I keep seeing all these new buildings going up to all the hospitals. So I don't argue the point. I get it. I'm just trying to help.
And Mr. Chair, I think he did. So it is a critical need. We see these hospitals in crisis, and we've got to kind of pay attention to it, would be my suggestion. The healthcare infrastructure in much rural Minnesota is experiencing financial stress, as I mentioned, but what that is doing is you have an aging infrastructure. Nursing homes, clinics, critical access hospitals all have aging facilities. In many cases, they've been able to stay open by sacrificing regular maintenance and upkeep. So you've got this pent-up demand of infrastructure that is aging and is in need of upkeep. They simply can't afford it at this point. Again, Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement rates continue to drop, and this is putting significant stress on these rural providers, many of them at risk of closure.
What percentage of patients in the typical rural hospital are Medicaid and Medicare?
Mr. Chair, I do not have that number off the top of my head.
Let me give it to you. Fairmont, Minnesota is 60%.
I was going to say 60.
This guy, he used to be a legislator.
Yeah, well, he'll make it someday. It's 60% of the patients in Mayo Fairmont are on Medicare or Medicaid. And in order for the rest of us who are not, to have a hospital, we have to pay 17% more than they do in hospitals that don't have that high percentage.
No, exactly. And Mr. Chair,
and I got that right from Rochester.
In some cases, the percentage is actually higher. So here's another analysis. Okay, this is a study by the University of Wisconsin and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which ranked overall health of Minnesotans by county. And the worst health problems were found in rural parts of our state. Poor health outcomes particularly concentrated in north central and northeastern Minnesota. So as far as outcomes, you know, we talk about how can we do a good job of cost-effective outcomes? Are we going to pay for outcomes? The outcomes are not looking good right now in rural Minnesota by and large. So in summary, the Minnesota Rural Health Association is strongly supportive of House File 211, Senate File 3 for its effort to add rural mental health professionals, public health nurses, dental therapists, advanced dental therapists, and nurses. And I understand there will be some others possibly added to the bill today because we have a critical need for these providers. And with that, I'll thank you. And Mr. Chair, any questions?
We covered a lot of questions earlier, but I think... there is a cost shifting happening in greater Minnesota, and I think we should work on having two states, greater Minnesota and Metro, because the Medicaid reimbursement in Iowa is 60-40, in Minnesota is 50-50, which is the worst there is, and in Arkansas it's 75-25. I think maybe we should make greater Minnesota 60-40 at least.
Mr. Chair, if that bill is authored, we'll be here to testify in favor of that as well.
You want to separate the urban area from the rural area?
No, I just...
Oh, all right.
I want those that have it pay for it.
Mr. Chair, are we ready to move on? Okay, thank you. I'll leave that hang out there for a while. Thank you very much. Members, House File 211 is intent is to expand upon the loan forgiveness program that we already have in the state. And the amendment that I have submitted expands a little bit to the professions that would like to join with, I guess we would need. I would like to move that if that's possible.
We'll Move the A2, right? The author of the bill would like to move the A2 amendment. Would you like to describe the A2 amendment for us a little bit?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, the practitioners that we would be asking to add to this program would, or this loan forgiveness program would be acupuncture, chiropractic, and physical therapist, along with the others that were added earlier, mental health and dental therapist. And public health nurse. I do have somebody that would possibly like to speak to the amendment. Do you want to wait until we put it all together first?
It's entirely up to you. Representative Norton, you have a question?
Yes, I did, about the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Very well.
Okay. Representative Keel, there was a workforce group that met on this issue over the interim, and I'm wondering, was this amendment part of that group? That was my first question. I've got another one. That recommendation.
No, I don't believe so.
Okay, so my second question then is, right now the bill doesn't have any financial amounts in it, and so I'm hoping if you move ahead with this amendment and with the bill that you are looking at increasing the amount, because I really fear that without a substantial increase in the base for the current bill and then for the addition, that you're going to spread that money so thin it's not going to make the kind of difference that you hope it will.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, that's exactly the intent. So, and we'll present that and talk about that a little bit too. So, but I would ask, would you please identify yourself?
Representative Johnson, you have a question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Keel, I too had concerns what Representative Norton had. In just in my community alone, with two nursing home facilities, there are 53 nurses short. Spreading this out in this funding, I think it could really hurt that in hurt not only the hospitals, but that industry as well. We have a big problem just in the nursing home with the nurses. Not only the nursing homes, but the hospitals at this time as well. And I'm concerned that if we spread it too thin, it's not going to do its intended purposes.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson. If we can explain, I think you'll maybe understand a little bit where we're going. So. Thank you.
Would you give your name for the record, sir?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Chuck Sawyer, and I'm the Senior Vice President at Northwestern Health Sciences University in Bloomington. I'm a chiropractic doctor, and over the last handful of years, most of my role has been involved with and immersed in health policy and all aspects of workforce and healthcare reform and the triple aim. And I was listening to your former colleague, Steve Gottwald, and agreeing with every point he made, especially the dilemma of rural Minnesota and specifically Medicaid reimbursement. But I'm here today to visit with you and testify in support of the amendment, because we've got a broader workforce that I think is under-recognized in our state, and it includes at least chiropractic doctors and acupuncturists. The view that I hold is that, you know, all these professions ought to be in, and we have to allocate more funding to healthcare, particularly in rural communities. We've got an aging Minnesota population, fewer health professionals or fewer medical students entering primary care, and that's a serious concern. and they all want to stay in the Twin Cities. With regard to doctors of chiropractic and acupuncturists, they are both primary access healthcare providers, and in the case of chiropractic doctors especially, a good part of what we do is primary care. Everything at the front end of a patient encounter, beginning with the history and following that, the examination, is the same primary care process as other providers. So we have a role to play in mitigating the very substantial disability burden that is caused by low back pain, among others. So In addition to that, I should tell you that as a chiropractic doctor, not only am I a not only do I have, and my colleagues have, significant expertise with regard to back pain, but I also know a lot about and care about the early manifestations of risk for type 2 diabetes. So when you put those two conditions together, which are extremely common, there's a strong argument to be made for relying more on chiropractic doctors to be involved with other healthcare professionals as part of an extended care team in dealing with chronic disease. So expanding the eligibility to these providers is also especially important because our students at Northwestern are training in a private institution, and yet our chiropractic students come out with debt that, last time I looked, which was 3 weeks ago, is right about even with students from the University of Minnesota Medical School, a public institution. So for many of our students, that means they are exceeding by, you know, at least a few thousand dollars, $200,000 in debt, and our average is approaching $160,000. Then they're going out into largely private practices, not health systems, where they get a paycheck right out of the gate, many times in rural communities where there are substantial numbers of chiropractic doctors, where, as Mr. Gottwald mentioned, there's a high concentration of Medicaid patients, especially now that that program is expanding. So I think if you connect the dots just on the economics alone, they are largely in practice by themselves, coming out with large debt, and yet providing a very valuable primary care and specialty care service. So we strongly support the policy arguments for expanding access to this program for the health professions that have been mentioned, and now the addition of chiropractic doctors and acupuncturists.
Representative Norton?
Yes. Dr. Sawyer, I wonder, did you testify or were you involved at all with the summer interim work by the work group that dealt with this issue?
We followed it. I did not testify, but in previous health reform task force meetings I did, but not most recently. But I was very aware of the work that was being done.
Okay, and because I'm just a little concerned, as I mentioned before, that we're adding, and I understand your concerns and share them, but I really am worried about, without seeing the dollar signs on here, whether, because you weren't part of the recommendation of that summer work group, I had hoped maybe you'd shared your case with them, and I would have some guidance then from their recommendation, but it sounds like you didn't, though you followed it. And hope that we can increase the amount on this bill to make certain that we don't, again, dilute the hoped and desired outcome.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, I agree. The funding is inadequate over across the board.
I'm sure you'll have a fiscal note before you go to Finance Committee.
Yes, we will move on. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can we move the amendment?
By me? I'm
going to move it.
Oh, the amendment? Okay. We move Amendment A2 for passage. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Thank you, members.
Your bill is amended.
So I'm going to invite Mr. Schoenbaum, that probably doesn't have a whole lot of time left. His bill is up in the Senate also.
I think we're fine.
Okay, good. So as you've heard already through Mr. Gottwald, and we'll hear the information here, you're all aware that rural areas are having some serious challenges with attracting and retaining. I'd probably say even retention is more of a problem, but bringing health occupations to our area and to the rural areas. And the workforce recommendations that Representative Norton was talking about are what I've asked Mr. Schoenbaum to explain for us, and so you have a little better understanding of what's where this study came from or where this bill came from.
Would you give your name for the record, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Mark Schoenbaum from the Health Department. I wear a couple of hats there. I'm the director of the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care, which focuses on the underserved in both rural and urban areas. And I'm also in the part of the Health Department that looks at healthcare workforce issues. And as part of that responsibility, we were very pleased last year when the legislature created the Legislative Healthcare Workforce Commission that they asked us at the Health Department to staff that commission, which we were, again, very pleased to do. You do have a presentation. We have a presentation and some slides. I think Representative Keel and I are going to share this.
Yes. It's a good thing somebody knows how to run this thing.
It's your computer.
Yeah, that's the sad part. It's my computer. Go ahead. This is the recommendations, if you want to.
Sure. You can see the membership of the commission there, five from the House and five from the Senate. The speaker just made new appointments to the commission, and I'm looking forward to working with them. The commission had a broad charge to look at the needs of the population of the state and whether the state had sufficient workforce with the right qualifications in the right places with the right skills to meet the needs of the population throughout Minnesota. Perhaps to Representative Norton's point, the commission did have as part of its charge a specific assignment to look at the primary care and specifically the medical student and medical resident population. The commission found, among other things, and the report is on the website of the Legislative Coordinating Commission, who houses such things. The commission found, among other things, that rural areas do have a variety of challenges, as Mr. Gottwald mentioned, in attracting and retaining health professionals in many occupations. And it did recommend an expansion and continuation of proven programs with measurable outcomes, like the Loan Forgiveness Program. There were a number of health workforce task forces and commissions underway last year. Another one, a parallel one, was the Mental Health Summit Task Force, Mental Health Workforce Summit Task Force. It also found that there are, not surprisingly, as all of us know, challenges in securing sufficient mental health providers throughout the state, and it also recommended an increase in the Loan Forgiveness Program and specifically adding mental health professionals to that program. Perhaps to elaborate just quickly on a point that Mr. Gottwald made, the Health Department does perform analysis on behalf of the federal government to determine which areas of the state qualify to be officially designated by the federal government as health professional shortage areas. And you'll see as we tick through these maps quickly that in both Greater Minnesota and in the Twin Cities, significant portions of the state, this first map shows mental health shortage areas. Most of Minnesota is a mental health shortage area. Most of Minnesota is a dental shortage area, especially for the low-income population. Significant parts of Minnesota are officially designated shortage areas for finding primary care providers, again, defined as primary care medical providers. And we find similar patterns in the inner cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, both for dental access and for primary care access. Let me turn your attention briefly to a handout in your packet on the Loan Forgiveness Program. This is a program that has been around since the 1990s. It has been subject to objective external evaluation a number of times. The front page of this handout gives you a little background and budget history on the program. The back page of the handout with the tables on it shows you what occupations are eligible currently in statute to qualify for loan forgiveness payments, and what the condition is, the requirement that they must meet to be eligible for those payments. So for physicians, it's rural and inner city, and you can read down the list as well. To the comment earlier about nursing homes, the legislature selected employment in a nursing home or similar facility as the requirement to receive loan forgiveness. So that's not a geographic requirement, it's a facility type requirement. And as you can see, the program, students who are graduating must commit to work at least 3 years in the areas that are defined in that left-hand column there. If they don't stay that 3 years, they have to pay the funds back with interest. They may stay also for a fourth year. So the initial role of the program is to recruit young graduates to where they're needed most. The evaluations have shown, and they were been updated on your handout, that not only does the program recruit young graduates to where they are needed most, but it appears to have a strong effect at retaining them in those communities or those facilities or similar ones for much of their careers.
Okay. This goes to the question of what the bill will do. Obviously, what Representative Norton and Representative Johnson pointed out, that the 700, I believe it was 700,000, a little over that, 740,000, isn't going to cover loan forgiveness for requests at this level. Senator Klassen and I have discussed $3 million to bring it up to, and while that's not a, it's a large number, but you know, with the spread out, that's the one question that we've had is, will that cover adding the chiropractors and those things? There are no, there is no real statistics out there to know the balance of what is needed also. And the bill also provides for that to let us know what the numbers are for physical therapist needs and chiropractors. And I don't know if any of you have noticed, but my nursing homes are starting to have in-house physical therapists because we are discovering that senior citizens do much better health-wise if they have somebody that works with them in the physical therapy efforts. And I have noticed that one of my nursing homes, and I'm bringing this up as an I'm kind of adding this to this conversation, but my nursing home has now offered a few beds for people who are doing rehab that could go home but have some struggles, and so they will stay in a bed there, almost like a swing bed, or back when I was younger we'd stay in the hospital and have more therapy. And I know I've talked to a few of my citizens right in Crookston that have said it's really worked out well for their families to make sure that that person is stable before they go home after a replacement of a hip or some type of thing there. And of course, then there's more access to, in that case, physical therapists. But I noticed that we're also starting to use more acupuncture for pain, back pain and some of those types of relief, especially in senior citizens where we don't want to add more drugs. You know, their drug therapy is getting a lot, and that keeps a little bit of a balance. So those are some of the concerns or the discussions that we may need to have along the way as this heads to finance. But The impact of this could provide up to 200 new healthcare providers in rural Minnesota over 4 years. That isn't 200 initially starting. Of course, when we add the other professions, that could water that down a bit, and encourages, you know, not provides just for physicians, but also for nurse practitioners, physicians assistants, which I think we're going to see a little more in rural Minnesota. Also for the mental health issues that we don't see as many people for professionals to help with those issues. And I just got done talking to some of my nurses in my district, and they expressed some real concerns about when they're seeing people in the emergency room needing to deal with mental health issues, and they're not quite equipped for all of that. And so I thought that was interesting conversation, that there's a lot more challenges in being just, you know, working emergency already in serious issues. So anyway, I will let you finish. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, so that impact statement, Representative Keel asked us to look at some scenarios. Again, this is not a health department bill there, but we did the arithmetic for that $3 million scenario, and the result is those 200 additional slots over 4 years that you see there. A little bit more about the mechanics of this program. Try and keep this brief. The concept is that if a young graduate is accepted into the program and remains in that required geographic area or facility type, or in the case of dentists, if they continue to see high numbers of Medicaid patients, if they remain in the program for 4 years, the state will on average be paying off about 60% of their student loans. And the way we calculate that is we get information from the higher education institutions on the average debt that these occupations leave school with, and they're entitled to an annual payment of about 15% of that average each year for up to 4 years.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I know we're not a finance committee, so I don't want to dig too deep into this, but I've got two questions here. The mental health professional, which is a $10,000 annual award of $40,000, I had a psychiatrist student in my office yesterday talking about, you know, $150,000 to $200,000 worth of debt for their medical and psychiatrist. And is that underneath your mental health professional?
Mr. Chairman? Representative Mahoney, no. Psychiatrists are in the physician category.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair, I just did the math here, and I know I'm, you know, just a pipe fitter.
Amazing pipe fitter.
Yeah. It just one of each of these totals up to $486,000 over their four-year period. I mean, that. Are you sure $3 million is going to get you 200 new health? Are you looking at a lot more nurses' aides, or are you looking at a lot of doctors?
Mr. Chairman?
Doctor.
Representative Mahoney, we calculated it a little differently. We took the average cost of a slot, and it's $60,000. And at $60,000 a piece, at $3 million, you can add 50 the first year. They stay for 4 years. You add 50 more the second year, you're up to 100. So by the time you get to the fourth year, you're at that 200. Then the fourth year is done, and a new first year comes in, and you stay at 200.
Mr. Chair and to Representative Keel, you know, Minnesota is a big state. We were looking at former Representative Gottwell's numbers, and I applaud 200. I think it's a good start. But it's pretty obvious that that barely scratches the surface of the need. Unfortunately, you know, it's hard to keep those professionals in Greater Minnesota. I fully understand it after 15 years on this committee. I've watched us spend tons of money training people in many different areas of the state, and they get $10 more an hour and they come down to this metro area. So at the end of the day, I know this is just the first start. You're scratching the surface, but how do you plan on keeping them? How do you plan on keeping the kids on the farm? And maybe that's not part of this bill, but after 4 or 5 years, there's no sense training them and spending all this money to keep them out in Thief River Falls and then having them move back home, back to the Twin Cities or Duluth or Sioux Falls or wherever.
Representative Mahoney, that is part of it. And if you look at this loan forgiveness program, it shows that there is a fairly good retention when somebody has planted themselves in a rural hospital or clinic, and when they've worked three to four years, have begun to start a family and stayed. Granted, there are some people that decide this is not for them, and I would guess that sometimes just being a rural physician or nurse or whatever is just not for them. And I will have to admit, I'm seeing some of my nurses work in a nursing home or something for a little while, and then they have the opportunity to go to North Dakota, where whether they choose to go in a nursing home and work or All True Hospital, they're seeing an increase right off the bat. Their wages are higher automatically. I think starting aid in East Grand Forks is around $11-$12 an hour. A starting aid in Grand Forks is closer to $15-$16. Now that has to do with the nursing home issue that we also have going on, but I think that we see migration that way too, and partly because of the opportunity, but also because they're funded. They're just making more money. I haven't checked Moorhead, but I would expect that Representative Lean would see that also, although there isn't a medical facility in Moorhead, is there? Excuse me.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Keel, no, there's not, but we do have one large non-for-profit health nursing home, senior care facility in Moorhead, and it's very much the same issue. It has largely to do with reimbursement rates between the two states, one being you go back to the 50s or so, North Dakota as a state decided they were going to put more focus into nursing homes because of some problems they had with institutional care, and number two, because of the oil revenue they're seeing right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I was just going to ask Mr. Schoenbaum, did you have anything to add to the numbers or the conversation? Okay.
No, I think you pointed to the results on the handout, and I'm going to do the same thing.
Okay. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers. I'm fairly unfamiliar with this program, so I'm learning a little bit here. The payments that are actually made for the loan forgiveness, they're direct payments to the nurse or the doctor or the dentist. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair?
I'll let Mr. Schoenbaum
answer. Representative Sundin, yes, they are. At the beginning of the program, before they're accepted, the applicant has to document how much they have in debt. They do get one payment each year. Following that payment and before they get another one, they have to document that they have applied the state payment against that debt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Is that taxable income then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sundin, it used to be, but it is not any longer by either state or federal government.
That's exactly what I wanted to hear. Thank you.
You know, one thing I've always wondered about, if I can buy a house for 3.5% interest, what is a school loan? And what is the most important?
Mr. Chair, it's probably a conversation for another day, but yeah, I just
seems
my
like
eldest
should be a new federal program.
My Mr. eldest Chair. To my youngest are paying. There's a lot of difference in their interest rates.
Mr. Chair, there is a senator in Washington who has been trying to formulate a new program to let students refinance their loans, but there's a congressman that keeps saying no. I don't know. I don't want to mention names, but I'll let your staff figure out who they are.
I think I do know. Thank you. That's what gave me the idea.
It's a bipartisan world.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, regarding loans, I think they have a new idea on a loan these days. It's called a parent loan. So the parent is given the opportunity to pay for the loan of their student when they're in college. It's about 8.5%, I think, which is weird given the fact that mortgage loans are 3% and 4%. But that's not why I wanted to speak today. I wanted to ask you a question to the testifier regarding the nine. I think there's 8 or 9 different occupations there. Can you just rank? Do you have the information to provide a ranking for which of those 8, maybe the top 3 are most, there's a greater need? Is there a greater need for one area of the 9 than any other here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barrett, I don't have that precisely. You know, I think, you know, there are projections out there on the number of physicians, dentists, certainly nursing home nurses that the state will be short. I can tell you how this program administers those relative differences. There is one pool for loan forgiveness, so to the point of new occupations going into the pool, they all go in the same pool. The health department then collects data from Department of Employment and Economic Development or the hospital or nursing home industry, whatever it may be, to establish the vacancy rate of, say, physicians in rural Minnesota or nurses in nursing homes. And the funds are divided, accorded proportionately by where the vacancy rate is highest. So if there are, say for the moment, if there is balance in the number of rural pharmacists, they get a smaller share of the pool than nurses, than is available for nurses who agree to work in nursing homes.
Just a follow-up to that, Mr. Chair. I think we're kind of thinking of it similarly in that, you know, would it be fair to say that a group, a type of profession like a physician in which there are relatively lower numbers compared to nurses and mental health professionals would have a higher vacancy rate because the numbers are smaller? And it leads to my main point of if a lot of this money is being used in some of the higher paid positions, physician, dentists, pharmacists, so we're bleeding through that 700,000, 800,000 quicker, it would seem to make more sense to allocate it to areas in which there is a great need, in which the annual award amount would be smaller, so you can flood the rural areas more efficiently with more people who could benefit. Any comments on that? I know it's a little bit convoluted, but
Representative Barrett, I think you've got a feel for this program. The funds in the pie, so there's $740,000 now. It's the money that's divided proportionately. And so if there's, say, $150,000 available for physicians and $150,000 available for nursing home nurses, the nursing home slice of the pie buys more slots than the physician slice of the pie. So it kind of works out that way.
So just a final thought, if I could. I guess I would add to that to say then if the nursing home need is greater, then maybe it shouldn't be an equal share between that and the physicians. Maybe nursing homes should have twice as many dollars in physicians. I don't know that to be true, but that might be a way to look at it so that the money could be better allocated to the more needed parts of our healthcare system.
Mr. Chair, just quickly, Representative, that is how it works. So if the vacancy rate is 10% in nursing homes for nurses and 5% in rural hospitals for physicians, then nursing home nurses get twice as big, twice as much money.
Thank you. You're doing what I thought. Thank you. Or what I would like. Thank you.
Representative Keel.
Mr. Chair, I think
we have one more question, but go ahead.
Ms. Everholden needs to go testify in another committee. I would guess that Mr. Schoenbaum does too. So could we hear from her first, please? Thank you.
Okay.
Thank
Welcome.
You. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sue Everholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. The 2013 legislature directed MNSCU to develop a comprehensive plan to increase the number of people working at all levels of our mental health system, to also ensure appropriate coursework and training, and to create a more culturally diverse workforce. And the reason for the legislation is that 9 out of the 11 regions of the state are designated as mental health workforce shortage areas. And it's not just psychiatrists, it's all mental health professionals. We actually have counties in our state that do not have licensed clinical social workers or psychologists, nurse practitioners who specialize in mental health, and there are also shortages of marriage and family therapists and professional clinical counselors. You should have received this truly wonderful report. I'm not always one that says, oh yeah, these are great reports, but this one actually is. And it really is based on hearings that were held around the state, surveys, and an actual summit. And one of the key recommendations is to expand the loan forgiveness program to mental health professionals in the rural areas and from to people from culturally diverse communities. So House File 211 creates those, you know, loan forgiveness programs, at least starting in the rural areas of our state, to make sure that we have folks who can do that. One thing I want to point out is that even if you expand funding for our mental health services, which of course I hope you do this session, we may not be able to really expand those services because our mental health providers can't find people to actually do the work. We know this is especially true with our school-linked mental health grants, which are, you know, one of the best in the country in terms of a model, but in rural Minnesota they can't find the people to actually carry out the work. So in order to expand our mental health services across the state, we need more mental health professionals. So I certainly urge support of this bill, and we appreciate the work that's been done to get us here. And be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Seeing no questions, thank you very much for your testimony. And now we'll go for the questions for Representative Norton.
Yeah, and Suda, you don't have to stay for this, but there were a couple things that I wanted to touch on, and I think Representative Keel's bill here is a part of a bigger effort. The University of Minnesota has a large request for healthier communities that's going to be coming before the Higher Ed Committee, I believe. I don't think it comes here first, but so this is part, I think, a very important part, actually, of the workforce shortages we have in rural Minnesota and across, and even in underserved populations. So I thank you for that. But I wanted to touch on the mental health piece in particular, and perhaps you know where I'm going to go, but there was a bill that was about a pipeline bill that we've been working on for the last couple years to try to get more jobs in a dual education and apprenticeship type model, and we've been working on that over the interim, and one of the key positions that was identified was a mental health worker through that program. And so my hope is that this will actually tie to that eventually, but we're still in the development phase. Representative O'Neill has the bill this year, and we're still working out some details. It's not quite ready for prime time, I think, but one of the positions is a mental health worker, and we're hoping for a shorter term. Doesn't have to be a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but there's a need for people who are skilled and trained in this area and perhaps can help fill the gap. And then it looks like you... Ms. Afterholden's come to the table. But the last point I just wanted to say to all of this is one thing I've never wanted to do, I've never wanted to see the state do. I fear often that we are headed that way, and I certainly hope we stop ourselves, is that I don't want to create a two-tier system for health care in this state. I don't want people in rural Minnesota not to have access to top-trained professionals or professionals with specialties. And while I have been supported and carried legislation for mid-level practitioners, we need to make certain that a physician is available in a hospital and in rural Minnesota, and that we don't simply fill slots with mid-levels or maybe some of these a tech school. We need them all. And so I just I appreciated your explanation about making sure that it's proportional, and I think we need to continue to make certain we don't create two tiers.
Ms. Abderholm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton. Actually, one of the kind of things that came out of that workforce summit is that we're trying to create career ladders so that people coming in on a very entry level, that some of those hours would count towards being a mental health practitioner. And the other thing that we've done is, and this was actually also in the 2013, but we've actually now completed the work, is through MNSCU identifying classes that could certify someone to be a mental health behavioral specialist so that, you know, they don't have to work through the provider. They can actually get that training through MNSCU, get some credits towards a college degree. And in addition, some language that's was introduced in the Senate today is if you're a peer specialist, so you're a person who lives with mental illness, doing well in recovery, and we have that already in statute, that you can actually, instead of going to a two-week training at the Department of Human Services, you can take classes at MNSCU. So again, you're kind of creating a career ladder so people can move up, you know, as they get more experience.
And Mr. Chair, just to kind of, I think, draw this full circle, one of the things we are hoping to do with the pipeline bill is have people, because we know the need is crucial, to have people be going to school and learning on the job at the same time so we can access those techs quickly. They can learn while they're working, and we talked a lot about having stackable education credentials. So just as you're saying, if someone comes in at a low level, they go through a shorter training, they do on-the-job training, then from there they can add to that education and that credential and keep working up and be able to move up in the system at the same time meeting the crisis that we have in mental health and other areas in rural Minnesota and underserved populations. So I think it'll be a win-win, and I'm really hopeful all these efforts and bills can kind of coalesce this year and we can get them passed so that we can move forward. But I really thank you for that.
Next we have Representative Moran. No, excuse me, you got Representative Lee first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple lines of questioning here. Mr. Schoenbaum, correct me if I'm wrong, but I had thought you had said a little earlier today that in some of your, in putting together what you estimate is going to be needed to fund this bill, you had said that, you know, each award or applicant gets about $60,000 in aid for their student loans. Was that correct?
Mr. Chairman, sure, Representative, if you take all of them on the slide and kind of average that annual award amount and take it times four, that's $60,000.
Okay. And thank you, Mr. Chair. And did you then, in addition to just that $60,000 number, did you put any weight into the sector needs, kind of along with Representative Barrett was saying, where, you know, you kind of parcel out the funding based on, okay, we need this many physicians, this many, you know, dental hygienists, for example. Is that also going into the projections of how much may be needed to fund the bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, kind of the variable that does that in statute is the vacancy rate in each occupation. It's a variable, it's a piece of information that is fairly readily available. It doesn't capture everything you're talking about, but it allows the program to adjust the division of the funds between professions over time as the need, at least as indicated by that variable, changes.
Okay, and thank you, Mr. Chair. And so did you then, I don't know, take that into consideration at all when you put together that estimate? I believe Representative Keel said about $3.7 million that would, additional funding that would go into the bill, or just?
$3 million in total.
$3 million in total, okay. Was any of those variable rates taken into consideration, or was it just that average of $60,000 per individual?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, this is not a health department bill, so the health department's not proposing $3 million or anything. But in providing assistance to Representative Keel, we ran the numbers for her on that $3 million, and we did use just kind of a rough average.
Okay.
So it's not adjusted.
Okay.
Based on
the, okay. And thank you, Mr. Chair. And kind of jumping to a different subject here, different topic. Do you also plan to do any additional outreach efforts if we're putting more dollars into this bill, of course we want to make folks aware that, you know, this resource is out there. If people are thinking of going into these fields, you know, and this may be a factor that would weigh into that decision, how are we going to make folks out there more aware of this program, that there is more funding out there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think the members of this committee have a good feel for this program. It's small, it receives more applications than it can fund, and as a result, we don't do much marketing because we don't want to raise all kinds of expectations that the program can't support. Should more funds be appropriated to the program, we do more marketing.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm getting a sense that a lot of ideas this session are kind of on a wait-and-see basis, how much funding is available, and, you know, be able to do what we can with what is available. So, thank you.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Lean just asked my question that I had of you, but I would like for you to maybe try to expand on that question about how do we get this information out to communities, because so often, you know, and the hope is that, you know, that we are not just reaching the usual people that we reach, but that we are also creating a more diverse workforce. And so often that information doesn't reach diverse communities. And so what I heard you say is that we're not doing any marketing at all. But how do one learn about the loan forgiveness program?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moran, we try and spread the word of the program mainly through the college and university training programs, education and training programs, and throughout the state. A lot of them, particularly University of Minnesota, is concentrated in the Twin Cities. You know, should their program be larger, we will do more of that. We will do our very best to reach out as far as we can to the breadth of people that the state needs to serve the needs of the growing diversity in the state. I can promise you that. This program does not solve all of our workforce problems. I think that one of the key points of contact with health profession students is towards the end of their education, when they are making those job choice decisions, when they're looking for a job and, you know, worrying about how they're going to pay off their loans and how the job is going to contribute to that. But earlier on, in earlier levels of education, when people are deciding what career to go into, it can also be very useful to let them know that should they choose a health career and choose to go where they're needed most, they would have a shot at a benefit like a loan forgiveness award.
Mr. Chair. So kind of like what I think I heard you say is that the onus is on the institution to inform their students or graduates of a possible loan forgiveness program. It has nothing to do with the Department of Health to initiate any of that awareness, but pretty much just left up to the institutions.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morton, no, I'm sorry if I gave you that wrong impression. It is the department's responsibility to market the program to kind of match, again, the funds that we have available. We need to reach students when they are thinking about their starting their careers and looking for a job, and a good place to reach students is at colleges and universities. So we go to the colleges and universities.
Okay, thank you.
What do we get next? Last. Okay, any other questions for this testifier? Seeing none, we now have Kathy Pickard, physician's therapist. Thank you very much. Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Picard. I'm a licensed physical therapist, and I am the legislative chair for the State Association. Thanks for this opportunity to allow me to come and speak in favor of the inclusion of physical therapists in House File 211. It's important to note that this loan forgiveness program is designed to fill the gaps in workforce shortages throughout greater Minnesota and in underserved areas in the metro area as well. It offers, however, no rehabilitation or no health promotion component to this program. So when I speak to the need, I like to just draw your attention to the fact that as the public understands more and more the value of physical therapy, and as the aging population is coming upon us, there's a greater need for physical therapy. And projections by our national associations show us that there's actually a greater deficit of workforce in physical therapy than any other primary care provider that's been listed under the National Health Services Corps. So there's a greater need in the physical therapy world than really any other profession, according to them. Our national association also predicts that there's a potential shortage of PTs by about 27,000 nationwide by the year 2020. With regards to our debt load, physical therapists, after a seven-year doctoral program, typically graduate with $120,000 of debt, and their initial salaries throughout the state of Minnesota is about $65,000. There are currently no state or federal programs that offer loan forgiveness for physical therapists. I'd also like to point out that there's a benefit beyond just rehabilitation by including physical therapists in this program. The obvious is that physical therapists do rehab for people who have injuries or conditions after the fact. But we also are very much engaged in health promotion, mainly because the ability to move and be active and engage in exercise is the building block of health. So by that nature, physical therapists are today's dynamic link between health and health care. So not only can we meet the rehabilitative needs of a community, we can help in the effort to get a community to be much more healthy through activity and exercise. My last comment really just asks that you think about this program a little bit differently. I'm really glad for the discussion by Representative Barrett asking about the needs. It seemed in the past the need was really more around the applicant. What did they need? What was their loan debt? But it's good to see that there's the need of the community being taken into account. And what that need might be does not pit provider against provider. It's really what does that community need, and that's good to find out. Well, how we'd like you to look at this a little bit differently, however, is that there is, in fact, a very large primary care gap in greater Minnesota. And a large percentage of what comes through the door of a primary care provider in an outpatient setting is appropriate for the physical therapist to manage and treat. Physical therapists are trained at a doctoral level in a direct access primary care model. So we can fill the gap. We're in a community where they may need a second physician. And if they really looked at that real need, that vacancy could be filled by a physical therapist who sees musculoskeletal conditions that are otherwise being seen by the primary care physician. Things like back pain, neck pain, shoulder pain, ankle tendonitis, all of the musculoskeletal conditions are such that physical therapists could be the primary care provider for those conditions based on our education and training. There's a lot of studies out there that show the sooner a person gets to a physical therapist for those kinds of condition, the more there is cost savings to the system and greater health outcome. There's good data, especially in the world of low back pain. The claims data by insurance companies point out that when a patient comes through the door with low back pain to a physical therapist, the cost of that care, the total cost of care, not just the cost of the physical therapy, but all of the care associated with low back pain for that episode, is far less than if they enter the door through a primary care provider. So we're here to say that we can do dual purpose. We can provide the rehab component. We can fill in the primary care gap if you allow us to do that. So physical therapists today, as I said, are trained at the doctoral level. We stand ready to fill that gap that everyone's worried about and that we can't produce enough primary care providers for. If we're allowed to participate in this program, we can send physical therapists out into rural areas to do just that, in addition to helping increase the overall health of those communities. So I'll sit for any additional questions.
You must have covered it wonderfully. Thank you for your testimony. And that's the last testifier. Is there anybody from the audience that would like to testify? Seeing none, would you like to renew your motion, or would you like to have a closing statement?
I'll take advantage of both, but I know we need to get going. I appreciate everybody listening to this. I think this is a really important step in our House File 211 is an important step in helping our rural communities. But I wanted to point out that little conversation I see Representative Mahoney has left, but that conversation about being two health cares, I personally had an experience now over the weekend. My mother got sick. She went to see her primary physician. It turns out that we are going to have to not only use primary care in Crookston, but she is going to have to come to the university. And so while we have a great doctor in Crookston, he's not able to handle her next step. And I really appreciate the fact that I don't have to leave Minnesota to be able to take care of her. And it's a 5-hour drive, but she'll do fine with that. And I just think that this really is a good program to help promote Minnesota health, you know, health of ours for our citizens in general. And I truly understand. I want you all to know that I really do understand that we have some professions that we need to see more of in different balance with our nursing staff. And I think that we're headed in the right direction. So I would renew my motion and ask for a yes vote. Thank you.
Representative Keel renews her motion to have House File 211 pass and be referred to Health and Human Services Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say nay. Motion passed.
Thank you.
And we have no other business, so we are adjourned.